Tech Session number 17352, Reel 3.
Mr. Crampton, Reel 3.
Right, yes. All that line of the German embankment was really bombarded with shells, and being so dry and dusty, it was really as good as a smokescreen, because the whole thing was like a great screen of smoke and dust and sand. And we withdrew. We came back to our own lines. But unfortunately, three of my men had been hit. And when I got back, the colonel was there waiting. Colonel Good, that was. He was a great man. And I was really sort of really very upset for the first time almost. I was really sort of very emotionally upset, and I wanted to go straight back and pick up the three men who were wounded. And the colonel gave me position, and I did. We went back with stretcher bearers and picked up the three men and some other stragglers. And it was quite interesting, because the barrage, of course, had died down by then, and the Germans were picking up their wounded from the other side of the wire, and we just waved to each other. And that was it, you know, just...
What was your attitude towards the enemy?
It was, I think, fairly standard soldier's attitude. I respected them, had no hatred. They were, and as soon as... Well, it was rather interesting that, speaking a bit earlier, those three paratroopers that we picked up in the sweep across Sicily, there was no animosity at all. There should have been, but there wasn't. It was just like, as soon as a chap is actually captured, then he's no longer anything to... And when he's actually in the shooting at you, he's not a human. He's a target. I found that again and again. We had no great dislike, but respect and... obviously, dislike of their cunning and their... But personally, not at all. And I think this was fairly general. Fairly general. They're units when they're against you, and they're units when you capture them. They're no longer a menace. Fascinating.
So, what do you think about the possibility of cruelty towards the enemy in battle or as captives?
I never came across it. Never. I came across a certain bitterness, but that was, again, with these three chaps, there was a certain sort of... They were beginning to get a bit edgy and a bit sort of master racist, you know, being a bit cocky. And I put a rifleman in charge of them, and I told them that his family came from Coventry, and that kept them quiet. Because everybody knows about Coventry. There was, and that, of course, he was, well, anybody who had had that sort of experience was a bit more edgy. But he himself, again, the same thing happens. I mean, they were the enemy when they were behind their guns, but when they're not, they were just captives.
So what happened next to you after this probing patrol?
The next thing, I think that was my last patrol. I can't remember. I think I did four patrols. They were the important ones, and that was why I got my MC for that patrolling. The next thing, I got back after that fighting patrol. We came back, and then they did move. The Germans moved out. The following day, we went over as a battalion, marched right along the road. And having got through the positions where we'd been doing all this fighting, we saw the jerry dugouts. And there were great big notices of blackboards, Merry Christmas, Tommy, which seemed to be their maximum English. And we marched into Catania town. And there we were showered with flowers and grapes and figs. One old farmer came out and he said, "Oh, we've been waiting for you for 3 years." And then we sort of consolidated there. I think only for 2 or 3 days. The Germans had retreated, or were retreating along the coast to Messina. But the colonel, we had reinforcements, of course, from the depot. The battalion was made up with a new draft. And he said he was going to keep me on a leash. He didn't want me going out anymore. So he gave me a thing, put me on a thing called LOB, left out of battle. So I was left out of battle for the rest of the battalion, the rest of the Sicily campaign.
How did you feel about that?
I was furious. And I argued with the colonel. He was very... No point in arguing, surely. Yeah.
What reason did he give?
That I'd done enough. He wanted to give me a rest. That was his reason, and... it was quite pleasant, but it was just annoying. You get very emotionally involved with a platoon, I think more than with a company. There's only 30 of you, very closely knit, and I couldn't bear the thought of anybody else being in command of them. And they were very emotionally involved with me too, after all that, you know. "Oh, are we going out to the war again tonight, sir?" Vice flashing.
Where did most of them come from?
We had a lot from London, I would think. Probably a third were Londoners. And probably a third were Ulster. And a third, Free State. We had a lot of Free State soldiers in the London Irish.
How did the men from the Free State feel about it? Did they regard it as their war?
Yes, they did. And they liked fighting, I think.
Why should they have regarded it as their war when their country was neutral?
I don't think they thought much of De Valera, you know. The ones that came with me. They wouldn't have done, otherwise they wouldn't have joined up. My sergeant was a deserter from the Free State Army. And later, when he went back, he came to us, he was... of course, he worked his way through the ranks in the London Irish. He became a sergeant, eventually a sergeant major. And when he went back to the Free State after the war, they gave him his rank that he had in England. Obviously, and that was an awful lot of that, you know. My next batman after poor Hooker was shot was a fellow called Nihil. He came from County Tipperary. He was almost illiterate. Marvellous poacher, but a wonderful rifleman. My goodness.
Did his poaching activities help him be a soldier?
He was a wonderful patroller, yeah. I mean, the thing was, really, Conrad, I got to like it. I had a fascination for patrolling. It was so exciting. It's awful to say, but I mean, we didn't think of the killing, and that struck you all later, but at the time, the thrill of going out in the dark and knowing your way around and having these extraordinary men with you, quite fascinating. Anyway,
were there any communal tensions in your unit?
There were tensions in the officers' mess. I never came across it in the ranks. We had men from Ulster and men from the Free State, or from Era, as they call it. They got on extremely well. They used to wig each other occasionally, but very slightly. They used to say, one would say, "God save Ireland, fuck the Pope." And the other would say, "God save Ireland and bless Our Lady." You know, it was just... And I didn't come across any, except in the officers' mess.
What kind of thing did you come across in the officers' mess?
Well, the doctor was from Queen's University, Belfast. And he hated the priest. And he also hated our second-in-command for some reason. He was really one of the very bigoted Ulstermen, you know. Orange Lodge complete. And he was also a drunkard. Always half cut. Oh, there was something I should tell you earlier. I don't know how much of this you're going to filter out.
No, we don't edit it.
No. There was a case did this battle patrol, the last patrol. We'd been out there, as I say, from first light. And we were very short of ammunition. What were we carrying? And we soon shot that out. And any grenades left. And bounding over the Catania plane, came the ambulance. It was driven by Father Tracy, who was our Roman Catholic priest, pastor. It was full of ammunition. He chucked these ammunition boxes out of the back. And of course, the doctor was furious, because of course he and the priest had the use of the ambulance. But I heard later, been a terrible row, and the Father Tracy, the priest, he said, "Sean's out there, he'll want this ammunition." Yeah, and the priest said, "You can't take it, it's the Geneva Convention, you know." He said, "Sean wants the ammunition, I'm taking it." And he took it.
But did
it was extremely naughty.
Did the communal differences affect the efficiency of the unit, do you think?
Hard to say. There were obviously, in the mess, there were certain tensions, but I don't think they were mostly community differences or religious differences. I think they were personal. Bill Brooks, this company commander, he was commanding C Company. He had a reputation for being very, very tough on his subalterns. And his subalterns resented it. They were very, very, you know, they didn't like him. Yeah, the sort of thing that happened. I had an American friend who joined the regiment at the same time as me, Jeff Searles. He was a Californian. And he'd done a patrol over one of these awful ditches that they have in Sicily, deep gullies, when the bridges had all been blown. And he took his platoon across and had really quite a battle and lost two men. Then he came back to report to his company commander, and he was told off for losing Bregman magazines. That sort of thing, you know. Which really seemed very petty. But nevertheless, Bill Brooks was a very good soldier. But there was that sort of tension. There's another aside which I think you would find quite fascinating. One of the subalterns first night of the big attack across the plain, his name was Maurice Marin. He was Jewish, a very nice fellow, and he was in another platoon commander. And my sergeant and myself, Sergeant Madigan and myself, when we withdrew, we found Maurice wandering about. He lost his steel helmet. He had blood all over him. He was in a terrible mess. And we washed him up and walked back with him and handed him over to the medical officer, and he'd been shot right through the forehead in one side of the other, and he was still alive, you know. It's amazing. And it was a sort of accidental lobotomy, because later, after the war, Maurice used to go round to all the members of the mess he could find, visiting, wherever they were. And it was as if he'd been stuck in that time. And all the little mess quarrels, you know, people who didn't like so-and-so, they were still with him, years after the war. Time had stopped for him then. Very strange. Later, he came to see me at least three times, up in the late 40s. And he visited John Canterfer, my company commander, and so on, all the way around the... anybody he could find. It was really very, very tragic. Very tragic. And he was looked after very kindly by his parents. But I think he died about 1950.
Now, picking up your own story,
being
left out of battle, what happened to you then?
Well, we moved along. I was under the orders of a major who had also been left out of battle from the London Scottish, which was our parent battalion, and there were three of us, three officers. And we moved along to billets, sort of following the army along. Very comfortable, and just little camp. Well, they were billets, really, not camps. We stayed in different farms and were looked after by the locals. And that was only for about a week. When the battle was over, I can't remember how long it lasted altogether, the Battle of Sicily, but after Catania, there was a fighting over each little bridge. You know, it was one of these chasing, really. It was a rearguard action on the Germans' part. And they got across the Straits of Messina and established themselves in the Tour of Italy. Meanwhile, Montgomery was our commander then. He gave a great speech in Taormina, the Greek temple there.
Were you present?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was a big order group. Oh, I didn't miss that.
Any memories of it?
Yes, yes, he said, we're going to knock the Hun for six, which was what he always said then. We will go down to the beaches, he said, and we will shoot across the Straits of Messina, anything that will fire 6 miles or more, and we shall land a great invasion and knock the Hun for six again.
How did it go down with you?
Well, we got used to him by then. Nobody liked Montgomery, in my experience, in the army, but everybody respected him. They thought he was a marvellous general and they couldn't stand him. Partly because he didn't smoke or drink. To go back much further back, to before the Sicily invasion, we had a wonderful old group there, which I shall never forget, when I first met Monty. And it was, they have big open-air cinemas in Egypt. And the old group was, all the officers of the 8th Army were there. A lot. And all round this cinema, which is in the desert outside the Ismailia, there was a ring of red caps, 200 yards away. Everything had been swept clean, and there was this huge girdle of red caps, and all the officers there. The security was phenomenal. And you know, army orders always go in a certain routine. It is most awfully important, you know, information, intelligence, so on. And Monty came on the little platform by the stage and said, to start off, he said, I don't like smoking, I don't like coughing, I'll have no smoking or coughing. Dead silence, of course. He said, now we'll get on with this order group. He talked for 2.5 hours. And he followed the exact pattern of a proper order group, just as you give to your platoon. Information, intention. The intention, whatever it was to drive the Hun out of Sicily, and so on. And his information about the enemy troops, about the Allied troops, was absolutely riveting and fascinating. And nobody coughed for 2.5 hours.
This was in Ismailia?
This was just outside Ismailia, yes. Between Ismailia and Port Juvic on the canal there. He gave a description of practically every rank in the Italian army, in the Africa Corps, and in the American army. Because the Americans only just come in then. And he was so right. So right.
In what way?
He seemed to be able to sum up the weaknesses of each. and the strengths. He was saying that the... of course, it's a long time ago, and this is all woolly memory, you know. Never took it down. But the feeling was that he knew the inside out of every unit on our side and on their side, and where you could hit them. And his confidence was absolutely overwhelming. No doubt, no doubt at all. And he also was very good. He would, almost to the number, he would forecast the casualties. This is one of his great strengths. And he would always put that as his priority, the fewest possible casualties. And I learned later, really from Lord Alexander, who became our battalion's, our regiment's honorary colonel after the war. I got to know Alex quite well. He was also a good painter, and I used to see him at the Royal Academy dinners. But he said that Monty had this extraordinary capacity for judging casualties, and because he had been a field officer in the First World War, he'd seen the slaughter firsthand and would never have it again after that. And Alex, too, was the same. I mean, they both were. I think Alex became a colonel in the First World War. He was a Irish Guard. I think he got his colonelcy. But then they'd seen a terrible waste of men and wouldn't have it again. So they said. And that, I think, got through to the troops, you know. They do know. Alex was immensely popular. He was loved, I would say, as a commander-in-chief. Very different style.
In what sense?
In that he would have a little touch of Harry. He would go along and talk to everybody, anybody, and he had a very gentle, mild sort of manner. Oh, he was a very, very tough commander. Whereas Monty was this great showman, and the troops don't like showmen, really, you know. They were, he gave them confidence, but it was a, they felt he was slightly spurious, you know. Although his first talk, really, this came over the air. It was broadcast to the forces, the Middle East forces, when he said, there is an excellent general in the desert now, General Rommel. He said he's a marvellous general with very good tactics and very good strategist. He says, now there's a better one. That's me. And that went down well, because that was the time when things were bad, you know, and Alamein was threatening Egypt and so on. They liked that. But it went on a bit too much. Yeah, anyway.
Now, coming back to Italy.
Left out of battle.
Story.
Yeah.
Did you stay left out of battle?
No, when I was rejoined after the end of the battle, we all joined up again, of course. The whole units were strengthened and really got drafts from the Middle East, made up to full strength. Then I got a quinsy in my throat, and I was sent back to the mainland because this wretched doctor put a query diphtheria on my medical report. Of course, that was a terror if they thought you had diphtheria. So I was sent back to North Africa, to Tripoli, to a base depot. Well, first to a hospital and then to a base depot there. Here is another saga starting. Base depots are places to be avoided. They are full of loose troops who don't know where they're going, waiting to be drafted in blocks, waiting for transport, waiting for ships. And then there's a quite a smattering who are dodging everything and longing to stay in base depots and organizing concerts and tombola games. It was absolutely awful. And I can't remember how long I was there, but certainly not more than a few weeks. Well, I got drinking in the officer's mess there, which was a big, huge mess, you know, with a group of sailors who were on landing ship tanks. They had these huge landing ships. And they were taking their ship to Taranto. And I'd heard, of course, by this time that the Salerno landings had taken place. Italy had been occupied. Well, they'd started there. They were about fighting around Naples. And as I say, I got drinking in this with these sailors. And they said they were going to Italy and would like to go with them. So I just packed up my kit, what a little I had, and I joined them in the wardroom in this thing. We sailed that night. And 2 days later, we were in Taranto. So I was actually posted as a deserter from the base camp. Then in Taranto, I discovered that you have two battalions, you know. London Irish had two battalions serving in the same theatre. One was my own battalion, had been detached from the 8th Army and joined the 56th London Division, which was being used as a stiffener for the American 5th Army. And our second battalion was in the Irish Brigade of the 78th Division. And they were going up the Adriatic side of Italy, and we were on the Naples side. And I discovered this when we were in the base camp in Taranto, which in fact was a huge aircraft hangar. That was pretty awful. But I found there that a group of my own London Irish 1st Battalion men, six of them, had found themselves there through being invalided out and sent to the wrong side. So I had a word with the camp commandant and said I was wanting to get to the other side. He said, "Oh, that's right, old boy, there's a train going." "Train? Yes." So I gathered together my six riflemen and said, "We can get across on this train." And we found that there was a train of armoured cars going across from Taranto to Naples. And we just got on it, you know. And it was an extraordinary business, because as soon as the train, it was open trucks with little armoured cars in each, about, I think, 30 of them. And at the back there were two passenger coaches with us in them. As soon as the train left Taranto Harbour, Taranto Station, it got covered with civilians. They climbed all over the trucks, stacks of them, like swarms of bees. And it was so heavy that the train could scarcely pull it. And it took 3 days to get across. And when they came to a hill which was particularly difficult, or a tunnel which was particularly difficult, they got everybody off and charged this hill, but they took a run at it. Got to the top and waited for all the crowds to come back on. Then went down the other side. Seemed mad.